And it's time for another episode of the Fifth Estate. This is the pre-Thanksgiving episode. My name is Jay Caruso. I am here with my co-host, Mr. Neil Doing. How are you, sir?
I am ready to fly, Jay. I'm ready to fly like a turkey.
Yes, Neil is flying out of the state of Virginia to go to the great state of Connecticut for Thanksgiving.
I'm excited about it, I must say. And you know what else I'm excited about, Jay?
What's that?
I'm excited about the chance our listeners have to subscribe to this podcast and leave us a review on iTunes.
Yes. We hit that 50 mark. Remember what I talked about last time? I said I wanted to get the star ratings up to at least 50. We've hit that. People listen.
Got to set goals. Got to go for them. Thank you, listeners. You're making our dreams come true. I just want to say I'm thankful for you.
There we are. Something to be thankful for as we go into Thanksgiving. Another thing we are thankful for is having good guests to talk about stuff. And, you know, we spoke to somebody from the decision desk last week talking about the actual, like, numbers as they were rolling in. And so we wanted to get more of a philosophical discussion about, you know, the election, the post-election, and other areas. And I saw our guests kind of opining on Twitter, as many people are going to do. And I said, hey, you know, I sent him a message and I said, you know, would you be available short notice? And he said yes. And so that's great. So Jay Cost from the Weekly Standard is here this week. Jay, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. I'm pleased to be here.
Oh, well, we appreciate you taking the time and, you know, with Neil's schedule and everything like that. So this worked out perfectly. Before we jump into everything, kind of like, you know, give the audience, I mean, I'm sure most of our audience kind of understand who you are, where you work, what you do. But, you know, just kind of give us your background and how you got into what you do and all that good stuff. Go ahead and let everybody know.
Yeah, I took a very serpentine path to get where I am. I was in graduate school at the University of Chicago back in 2004, and was just sick and tired of all the stupid pundits on television talking about the election, and thought, oh, I could do this better. So I started a blog, and I did kind of a quantitative kind of blog, you know, where you know, poll aggregation, you know, vote watching, voter registration tracking, a lot of the stuff that people do nowadays. I did it in a very, like, basic, you know, spit and polish kind of form, and it just kind of took off. And I started writing for Real Clear Politics. And then in 2010, I went over the Weekly Standard, and I've written two books. I wrote a book called Spoiled Rotten, which is a history of the Democratic Party. And then I wrote a book that came out in 2012. And then in 2015, I wrote a book called A Republic No More, which is a history of political corruption. And I am right now I'm finally finishing that dissertation. It's only taken me 14 years and counting, so but I'm almost done, and it's a study of Madison and Hamilton. So, and I hope at some point over the next 2 years it will become a book in some format, because I've been really enjoying that research. So,
and that is an interesting relationship. So I imagine there's a lot of stuff to cover there.
Yes, it's a fascinating. It's really fascinating because they got along incredibly well in the 1780s. They're very different, personalities, but they had a real intellectual kinship. But it was totally disintegrated within a year in the new government, as Madison came to oppose all of Hamilton's economic policies. But after Hamilton died, Madison ended up endorsing pretty much everything Hamilton had originally proposed. So, which is strange coming from a guy like James Madison, who really thought things through and was not kind of a fly-by-night guy. You know, he had good reasons for opposing Hamilton in the first place. So it's an interesting story.
It definitely is. And I think it's kind of funny, you know, once these guys became president, Jefferson and Madison, they sort of softened a little bit on the Hamilton hate. maybe not the hatred for the man, but certainly for his policies. So that is, that's fascinating. Well, that would be an interesting read. I think it would be a great book.
Yeah, I'm
optimistic. I hope people like it, because it's not something that a lot of times what I found is that historians tend to blow hot or cold on Madison and Hamilton. Like, you don't really read like a very balanced account. So for instance, the Ron Chernow biography of Hamilton is a very pro-Hamilton, which isn't a bad thing, but it really kind of misses the mark on where Madison was coming from. And then you see a lot of times on the opposite side, biographies of Madison. I think that's pretty typical, because biographers, you know, especially with guys like Hamilton and Madison, they tend to fall in love with their subjects. And so they tend to see things the way they saw things. But the two of them, because they didn't really understand each other very well, so they were kind of talking past one another, and so
doesn't that sound familiar?
Yes, indeed. So I'm hoping that people will find it useful.
Well, it probably will, and I'm kind of looking forward to it already. And the way you've explained it, so that's going to be interesting to see when that's completed. But okay, so. Let's take a turn. Let's talk about the elephant in the room, the election. I think nobody's more surprised than probably Republicans. I think that or conservatives that Donald Trump won. Were you surprised at the results? Are you one of the few who might have seen it coming?
No, I did not see it coming.
Okay.
I didn't see it coming. I should have followed Bill Mitchell and been counting the yard signs. and I say that only half facetiously, because I live in Western Pennsylvania, about 30 miles outside of Pittsburgh. So it's pretty rural. I'm like right at the edge of the suburbs. You go a little bit north and you're right in the rural area. And I was absolutely gobsmacked by the number of Trump signs up here. And I didn't take it as a sign of anything except just the intensity level. And I'm not sure that that really, maybe it wasn't a sign, but I will say what I do think happened, looking at it, and where I sort of, and I think where we all missed the boat, was I think most of us figured that, you know, there's this large group of people who disliked Hillary and Donald Trump, and that these people were going to swing to Hillary Clinton at the end, that they were going to bite their lip and vote for Hillary because, you know, come on. Right. But they didn't. That was what was so weird, that the people who disliked both of them, bit down and voted for him. And I think it turned out that there was this very strong correlation between vote for Donald Trump and right track, wrong track sentiment. So the people who disliked both of them, but the thought that the country was going in the wrong direction, ended up making their mind up for Trump. And the Access Hollywood tape didn't have any effect. The Putin stuff didn't have any effect. His disastrous first debate performance didn't have an effect. That push came to shove. The people who hated both of them voted for him.
And the confusing part, of course, was that none of the data that anybody was really looking at reflected any of this. All the polls that we were seeing, I was lulled into a false sense of security by the polling data. You know, I looked at these polls, they all put Hillary ahead, maybe not by a whole lot, depending on the day, but sometimes comfortably ahead. And there's a question there of, you know, were people just keeping it close to the vest? Did they not want to discuss their vote for Trump? Because it comes with all sorts of attendant baggage. So I think there's that aspect to it as well.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that another thing to bear in mind, too, is that a lot of people might have been hiding behind their third party vote choice. Right. So that, you know, Gary Johnson ended up only getting 3% of the vote. I think he was pulling at like 5%, and Jill Stein got 1% of the vote. She was pulling at like 2%. And that's a relatively small, you know, relatively small number. But if you think about the margins in all of these swing states, I mean, Trump won Michigan by less than half a point. He won Wisconsin by less than a point. You know, he won Pennsylvania by about a point. You know, Florida, he won by about a point. So if those people were kind of like hiding to pollsters, were hiding behind, Gary Johnson, and maybe even hiding behind Jill Stein, who knows? I mean, who knows what these working class whites in the Midwest, you know, there's this a weird kind of overlap between, you know, left wing, you know, working class politics and Donald Trump. But I think another part of the problem was, you know, we ended up, you know, getting a surprise in like Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. And those places were not, you know, Pennsylvania was polled more regularly, but, you know, Wisconsin and Michigan were underpolled. And so maybe we missed it, you know. But, you know, well, that was when, and I realized that he was probably going to win on election night. It was not so much, you know, Florida being on the razor's edge, because, I mean, come on, Florida's always on the razor's edge. There's something, something in the water in that state. I don't know. They're just like, they just have to be the center of attention down there for some reason. But what really like, I was like, oh my God, he's going to win, was when he won Ohio and like he won it running away.
Yeah,
and it
easily.
Was like, if he's going to win Ohio, and he won Ohio by 8.5 points. And you win Ohio by 8.5 points, it's going to be close all through the industrial mm-hmm. Midwest. And sure enough, you know, and that was the thing, like by midnight, it was like, well, if she wins Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, it's like, yeah, but she lost Ohio by almost 10 points. She's not going to win all three of them.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. That was the interesting thing, is as the night wore on and they weren't calling states like Wisconsin and Michigan for Hillary right away, even 2 hours into it, it was kind of like, okay, something strange is happening here. But it's interesting though about the polls, when, you know, this whole talk about the popular vote versus the Electoral College, but in the sense, if you look at it, the national pollsters are going to sit there and say, "Hey, we kind of got it right," because when all is said and done, she may win by about 2 to maybe 2.5% in the popular vote, and I think the RCP average was around 3%. So within the margin, easily within the margin of error, they're going to sit there and say, "Hey, we got it right. You know, you guys got to go talk to those state pollsters." And I think Wisconsin was the biggest one. She had a lead of anywhere from 6 to 7 points, I think it was. And then she underperformed, I think, Barack Obama by about 240,000 votes or something like that. It wasn't that Trump did so much better than Romney. It's just that Hillary did that much worse. But you did bring up a good point about the right track, wrong track. There was also the statistic. I think a third of the country said that they were worse off financially now than they were 4 years ago, and nearly 80% of those people voted for Donald Trump. So I think it was a change thing, and they saw, I think a lot of people may have seen Hillary as just an extension of the Obama administration, probably said, you know, we got to give somebody else a shot. And you're right, so all this other stuff didn't matter. So it's kind of interesting to see where that's going to go and what's going to happen the next time around, but I don't even want to get into that. But let's step back from the election a little bit. You were talking, Jay, you were talking about something I found to be very interesting. You were talking about partisanship in terms of how opposing ideologies see each other. That if you go back in time, there was, you know, very, you know, everybody was very passionate about their politics, but there was, you still said there was still a sense of the, you know, the general welfare needed to be taken care of. But now it's at a situation where, you know, too many people see the other side not as a political adversary, but as evil. You know, right. they're intending to do harm, that they're not, it's just not a different path that they want to take to the same result, but they actually want to cause harm to the country. And so let's talk a little bit about what that's going to mean, especially in a Trump administration.
Yeah, that's a good question. It's an unfortunate thing because, you know, so this is our country is a republic, right? And to borrow Lincoln's phrase, a republic is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And so to maintain a republic, what you really need, I think, more than anything else, is a spirit of republicanism among the people themselves. And this view that government is supposed to secure the general welfare, and there's an inherent equality among citizens. And that we're all equally entitled to respect, and you know, we shouldn't be condemning each other. And the example I had in mind, because what I'm bothered by the current sort of mood in the public. The example that I had in mind was the 1790s, which was a very vitriolic time. The political battle in the 1790s was very vitriolic, and it was really closely contested. And then Jefferson won in 1800. He won the presidency, and then he did something really extraordinary. In his inaugural address, he said, "We've been called brothers by different names, but we're all Republicans and we're all Federalists, he said, and differences of opinion are not necessarily differences in principle. Mm-hmm. And he said, and the thing is, okay, so that's rhetoric, highfalutin rhetoric, but, you know, he really kind of followed through on that. He pursued a moderate course of public policy. And, you know, for the next quarter century, their partisanship really disappeared in the country. And there was this sort of sense of unity. There were partisan battles here and there, and there were sharp differences. But there was sort of a sense of kind of, you know, we're all Republicans, we're all Federalists, you know, differences of opinion are not differences of principle.
And just it's the Stephen Decatur toast,
right,
about my country, right or wrong.
Right, you know. Exactly. And I just don't feel like nowadays, I really kind of feel that kind of ethos is missing. You know, I was in New York the week before the election. I was in New York City. So I didn't really have anything to do because I unfortunately just got there after Steely Dan's sessions at the Beacon ended and right before the new Rolling Stones exhibit opened. So I went to see a movie. And during the advertisements that John Fugelsang, I'm sure you guys know who he is, was advertising some comedy thing. And on the advertisement, he said it's like the redneck comedy festival only for smart and moral people is what he said.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Right. And it was just like, but this was like, this was geared towards the movie going public in New York City. And it's like, and this is not like a battle between, like, you know, Harry Reid versus Mitch McConnell, and they hate each other, which is to be expected because they're in a competition for political power and the gain for one is a loss for the other. This is talking to just average people in a movie house. And I was just really struck by that. And I think that, like, this idea that's percolating on the left, which is like this idea that, well, Hillary's comment, the basket of deplorables, and like they're debating, okay, well, what percentage of it of the Trump voters are deplorable? You know, like this is an actual debate they're having. Is it 25%? Is it 30%? Is it half? It's like, okay, if you're talking like 25%, you're talking like 20 million Americans are deplorable in Europe. I mean, that's a huge number. That's a whole faction of our society that you're just castigating as sort of like beyond, you know, beyond the pale. And, you know, if you listen to talk radio, conservative talk radio, I mean, they give as good as they get on this, where it's the liberals are out to destroy the country. They're out to destroy America. They want to flood the country with immigrants and destroy our way of life and blah, 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 blah. And it's just, there doesn't seem to be like a Republican spirit of this idea that, like, again, like what Jefferson said, that every difference of opinion doesn't reduce to a difference in principle, you know, because we disagree about whether or not gun control actually controls crime doesn't mean that I'm, you know, I'm a jerk or you're a jerk. It just means we disagree, and that's okay.
It has become so difficult to even voice disagreements with friends, neighbors, coworkers, anybody. Just the general climate has been poisoned, and it's, I think, partly been the entertainment factor. I think that I don't know if you saw the documentary about Buckley and Vidal. Best of Enemies, I think is the name of it, and it was about their contentious debate during the Democratic National Convention, and basically it was the first time those sorts of fireworks had ever been displayed on television in the news setting. But it sort of seems very tame compared to some of the, you know, talking heads that we see on TV these days. It's, I think, politics is blood sport a little bit, which is not a healthy impulse. But I think it goes deeper than that. It's this casting of people who disagree with you as morally reprehensible, not just mistaken, but wrong in every way.
Well, look what happened with the CEO of Grubhub. And I kind of wrote about this actually for the Weekly Standard, Jay, about, you know, the weaponization of politics. And I use the example, I kind of hearken back to the example of Brandon Eich, who was forced out of Mozilla simply because he made a donation to an organization that was pushing Proposition 8, which would ban gay marriage. And then you have the CEO of Grubhub send an email to all of his employees saying, you know, essentially, you know, he tried to backtrack, but basically the email was like, if you voted for Donald Trump, then you support everything he stands for. And, you know, really, we really don't want you working here. You know, and it's gotten to that kind of case where bosses are sending to their employees,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're kind of dressing them down simply because they voted for Donald Trump. And the fact of the matter is that you talked about this, Jay. You said there's over 60 million people voted for Donald Trump. Are they all bigots? Are they all racist? I mean, it's, you know, there's people out there who are struggling. And I think it was John Stewart who said, he goes, I have friends that, you know, they're worried about where they're going to pay their insurance premium. And he goes, I know them not to be, you know, bigots. And yet I know they're supporting Donald Trump simply for that reason. So I think you're right. I think the time comes when you got to take a step back and you got to say, okay, let's take a deeper look. And I'm guilty of this. I mean, I was never a Trump person. So, you know, I was one of these ones that didn't kind of like really listen well enough to what people were saying in terms of, I listened to the more extreme voices, but yet there was this portion out there, there's percentage out there that, you know, really it was kind of economic anxiety. It wasn't necessarily and if you look at it, the polls now, it's like over 50% of the people don't even know who Steve Bannon is. They don't know
right.
who Reince Priebus is. So it's kind of like, you know, we're always in that little in that bubble where we're arguing about stuff like that, and we're not really kind of out there. And I think it was Selena Zito who was out there in Pennsylvania, you know.
Yes, indeed.
Who was Absolutely. Out there interviewing people. And she was saying that she's not seeing what everyone else is talking about. What she's seeing is, and what she's hearing from people is different.
Yep, that's right. Look, I think, you know, something to bear in mind, too, is that this is a really, this is a self-defeating ethos. This idea of sort of like, we're the good guys, you're the bad guys. Our system of government. Part of the grand bargain in Philadelphia in 1787, right? Because we didn't have a government prior to the Constitution. We didn't have a government that actually worked and that could actually do stuff. And so there were basically two factions of people at the convention. There was a faction, Madison and Hamilton and James Wilson and Gouverneur Morris and some other people who wanted to actually create a government that could do stuff. And then there was the opposing faction, like people like Roger Sherman, who were not necessarily opposed, but they were really worried about the government overrunning the rights of the states. So the grand bargain was, okay, we will create a government that can do things when there is a broad consensus in support of the thing that needs to be done. So this is why we have a Senate that's designed the way it is, where every state gets two Senate seats. It's why we have federalism. It's why we have staggered elections. You go up and down the line. Our system is designed to, you know, only function and get stuff done when there is a broad consensus. So and, you know, this is not a country that works when the majority is 51-49. It's not going to work. It was designed not to work. And if you think that you can get to 51% by castigating the 49% and throwing them into outer darkness, well, you know, that'll be a nice election night for you. But, you know, come January, you're not going to get anything done because they're still going to have the filibuster. And guess what? There's an election in 20 months and you're going to lose seats. And so I just feel like, you know, what do you want to do? Do you want to make yourself feel like you're superior to your fellow Americans? Or do you want to actually solve the problems that we have? Because if you want to solve the problems, you got to go for 60%. 60% is really the threshold to really get stuff done in this country.
Well, and what are the prospects, I think, for the Republican Party with President Trump? Do you think that this cycle will continue? Do you think what the indications from Trump's behavior post-election, do you see him being the uniter that he talked about in his speech on election night?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think part of him will want to be a uniter. I mean, I think Obama wanted to be a uniter too. But I think that Trump and Obama have a very unfortunate a quality that they both share that's not well suited for the presidency, which is that they're thin-skinned. And I think that, you know, they take personal offense to they take personal offense to political criticism, operate under the false assumption that they're the first people to ever be criticized like this, which is just ridiculous. And so that what happens then, and we saw this during the Obama era where it was like any, you know, like Obama took personal offense and then suddenly like, you know, there was this racial dimension to criticizing the president. And, you know, people picked up on Obama's the offense that Obama was taking. And then they started thinking that, you know, conservatives were criticizing him because he was the first black president. And the whole thing just got this ugly cast of just sort of like, you know, this idea of the loyal opposition. I mean, it's a delicate concept in a democracy, the idea of a loyal opposition. And I think that, you know, Obama was not a very, you know, supporting a loyal opposition really requires the person in charge to have a certain level of forbearance toward his opponents and not, you know, and allow them in a way to attack him and to sort of carry yourself with the sort of bearing that is commensurate with your office. And Obama didn't do that. I mean, he aspired to that, I think, but he could be drawn into the mud and hit with sharp elbows. And I think that he signaled to his supporters that there was something really wrong with these other guys.
He would play to that crowd. Yeah, sometimes he would make these public statements that he didn't need to make necessarily, yes, but it would be a wink to the people who grooved on that.
Exactly. And I think that, you know, I think that's exactly right. I think that he would wink and nod to his side and, you know, and sort of character, and the way that he would characterize his political opponents was always the best you could ever get. The most charitable you would ever get would be the sociologist's pose, where he would sort of be looking down upon the benighted souls who live in small town America, who are basically pissed off and scared because they don't have jobs and therefore they have false consciousness. That was the most you could get. That was Obama at his most charitable, most usually. And I think that his political supporters really kind of picked up on this. And I'm afraid that Trump is going to do the same thing. I mean, obviously, Trump is never going to occupy the sociologist chair. That goes without saying. But you look at the way that he's picking fights already with the New York Times. And I just think that that's a recipe for more of the same. Sort of like this kind of this. And again, it gets to this idea of sort of zero sum kind of game. And look, zero sum is a strange kind of quality because a zero-sum game can get you reelected. So it got Obama back into the White House in 2012. And it might, you know, might do the same for Trump in 2020. But it's elections are only the first step toward reform in our system of government because there are a series of elections. So, like, for instance, Obama was elected in 2012 with a pretty comfortable majority. But then the country returned that House majority right back that had you know, had frustrated him so much. So I don't like that vibe that's coming from Trump already. You know, the last one who I thought really had that kind of big minded view of things was George W. Bush, whose presidency was overrun in its final 5 years by you know, these wars getting out of hand. But if you look at his domestic policy early in his term and you look at the way that he approached government, he had, I think, the right view of the role of the office in mind. And I don't think that the last two presidents really have had the correct, or I don't think Obama had, and I don't think Trump is going to either.
That does not bode well. I think I wonder what the prospects are for the Democrats to turn the ship around, though, because they seem to really be foundering. And as we discussed earlier, there's this sort of refusal to let go of assumptions and listen. And I think if we want to put it in terms of virtue, humility is one that is sorely lacking. And that's on both sides, but humility is generally something that the losing side needs to practice more. But I don't see that happening anytime soon. I see more humility from the defeated Never Trump Republicans than I do from the Democrats.
Yeah, I think that's right. Like if you look, for instance, like at the 2012 autopsy that the Republican National Committee did, I mean, I disagreed with a big swath of that. And ultimately, you know, ironically, Reince Priebus commissioned it. Now he's going to be chief of staff for the guy who basically tore it up and, you know, lit it on fire. So it just goes to show how committed he was to the principles in that document. But the act of commissioning it and actually researching it, thinking it through, demonstrated, I think, a level of humility. You know, and it's still early days for the Democrats. I mean, I think they all expected to win, so I think they're still probably reeling. I'll be curious to see how they approach this. And there have been voices who have been increasingly kind of shunted off into the wilderness who've been warning them about basically predicting what happened 3 weeks ago. People like John Judas and you know, other people have been kind of warning them, like, hey, you guys are falling apart with the white working class. And if you think you're going to hold the line forever, you know, that's a risky assumption. And I think that if you look at the electoral results, I mean, you see, you know, so Trump wins Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Iowa. So I look at that and he wins them on the backs of the white working class in most of those states, right? And I look at that and I see a revival of the old Republican political coalition that existed before the New Deal. And I think that there's a lesson for Democrats there, is that the New Deal's changed the political orientation of the white working class in the industrial Midwest. Because the Democratic Party committed itself to industrial unionism, trade unionism, strong wages, sort of bread and butter, Harry Truman, fair deal type of stuff. And so what have we seen in the last 20 years? We've seen, longer than 20 years, but the industrial unions have been in decline basically for 60 years, and they're almost a non-entity now. And that's an important development because the industrial unions used to, you know, were able to communicate directly with their members and basically keep their voters in line. They could deliver an actual vote on election day by just going through the shops, you know, and they're gone. But those working class people are still there. They're just not affiliated with a union anymore. That's a huge organizational problem for the Democrats. And for all their talk about, you know, their organizational, you know, facility, you know, how many people they contact, all this stuff that they do, you know, these calls they make and knocking on doors and all that stuff. You know, they're making up for the loss of the union vote, which was just basically there for them to be delivered by the United Auto Workers, the United Steel Workers, and so on and so forth. So that's one long-term trend. But then that's been compounded by, on the other side, you know, the democratic liberalism in the Democratic Party has gone from, you know, standard of living issues to quality of living issues. So it's no longer a liberalism that's predicated upon, you know, job security and wages and income growth. But now it's increasingly, you know, cultural issues like abortion and then, you know, increasingly environmentalism. And environmentalism, you know, the way environmentalism has developed over the last 20 years, it's now like it's now a dagger in the heart of a lot of these working class people, because it's like, well, you know, we have to control greenhouse emissions. And so therefore, we got to shut down your factory. And that, you know, and so I look at this, you know, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Iowa. And I see that's a crisis for Democrats of that's the crumbling of the New Deal coalition. And the question is whether or not the Democratic Party that's situated in Washington, D.C., in Los Angeles, California, and in Manhattan, none of them joined the Democratic Party because of that coalition. So do they understand the problem of having lost Dubuque, Iowa? The Dubuque was in the Democratic Party for different reasons than the Upper East Side of Manhattan. And are the people in the latter place who are still in the party, do they get it? I don't know if they get it.
Jay, do you think that the economic pressure or the cultural pressure is more responsible for the Democrats losing their grip on these people?
I think that the cultural pressure was sort of there first. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, a lot of we're talking about, and a lot of instances, we're talking about, you know, the Catholic vote in the North. We're talking about the Catholic vote in the North. And, mm-hmm. and I think that, you know, there's been a strain there on issues like abortion and, you know, gay marriage. But I think mostly abortion. But I think that they were still, I think these voters at their core were still pragmatic. The ones who were the voters who were the difference makers. I think that they, you know, look, they voted for Obama. Like Michigan went very strongly for Obama in 2012. And look, I think that that was a testament to their pragmatism. And the fact of the matter is that Obama bailed the auto industry out and he basically saved the state's economy, in their opinion. So I think that right now, the problem is more economic than cultural.
Well, and Jay, what, so if we're looking forward, even just 2 years, because I think there's a lot more Democratic senators whose states are in play than Republican senators. I think there may be 25 or something like that, I heard, Democrats who are going to be up for re-election in 2018. So, but the if you look at the totals where, you know, Trump won in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, I think the total is like 55,000 votes. It's not, there's not a lot of separation there. But what, so if you were going to, if you were advising, just kind of like, just kind of talking, if you were advising both sides and, you know, you say, well, here's the Republicans, here's what you need to do to kind of, in, you know, to increase that, because I know you've spoken about this before, or you've written about this before, where you say that the Republican Party has kind of catered not to necessarily towards the free market, but rather big business,
right,
and kind of left, you know, people behind. You know, there's always this talk of the medical device tax, which I know people are like always trying to talk about. It's like, and it does nothing for most people. Yeah, there may be some pass through, but at the same time, people are looking at it and saying, well, this does nothing for me. So, you know, forget about the Democrats for a second. We just kind of talked about them. But like the Republicans, you're saying, OK, if you want to keep these people going forward, what do you have to do?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that's a crucial question. And you're right, by the way, mentioning the narrowness of these states. And I would add that if you look at these states, you know, the Trump won. He won Ohio with more than half the vote. And I think he won Iowa with more than half the vote. Yeah, he did. But he won 47.5% in Michigan. He won 47, less than 47.5% in Wisconsin. He won 48.5% in Pennsylvania. So he did not win a majority of the vote. A majority of the vote in all three of those states voted against Trump. And so the Democrats, you know, what the Democrats are going to try and do is try and coalesce the outlying anti-Trump vote and bring it back into their coalition. This, by the way, is why I think George W. Bush was so smart, because I think that he recognized that when he developed his domestic agenda. He knew that, you know, he was a minority president from a popular vote perspective, but he was also a minority vote president from the perspective of, well, in to getting to 270 electoral votes, he wouldn't get there if the anti-Bush vote coalesced around, you know, somebody else. So I think that, you know, what the Republicans need to do is really, you know, I really like the way you phrased that with like the medical device tax. And I think that's a great example of the problem that the Republican Party's economic policy so often has, right? Is that you know, we talk about repealing the medical device tax and we can advertise like, oh, well, this will help people down the line. The benefits of it are down the line. You know, it's the same thing with corporate tax reform. You know, like we can debate the merits of corporate tax reform. And I think it's time we had some corporate tax reform. But the benefits for corporate tax reform for people who do not actually file income tax as a corporation are secondary. And they're to come at some indeterminate time and at some indeterminate level. And so I think that what the Republicans need to do is they need to find a way to make these voters feel like their lives are being directly benefited in some way, that the government is prioritizing their needs. And here's a piece of public policy that will directly help you. Now, how do they go about doing that? I think there's a lot of different ways to do that. The Democrats have an advantage in that regard because the Democrats will just create new government programs. So, you know, we need to win over this demographic. So here's this agency specifically tailored to basically distribute benefits to this demographic. And Republicans don't like to do things like that. They prefer, you know, to tinker with the tax code is particularly historically, that's how Republicans have distributed benefits. But they've really kind of hit a wall with that because they lower taxes so much that these voters are really not paying that much in income taxes now anyway. So now I think they need to start looking at things like, like education reform, something like that, to give people a handhold in these states, something where they can say, look at a piece of policy and they can say, wow, that was a good piece of legislation for me. Boy, I'm really glad the Republicans did that. Something like that. I think education would be one way. I think another thing, I don't think Trump's going to do it, to be honest, because, this drain the swamp thing, because I think Trump at his core is a swamp creature. So I don't think he's going to do that. But I mean, if I were advising him, I would be like, you should go after the special interests on both parties. Make yourself out to be the avatar, the tribune of the people railing against special interests and corralling Congress, demanding that Congress reform itself. Turn yourself into the advocate for the people and the general welfare against, and things like, a revolving door and term limits, although I don't think term limits are a good idea, but politically they're very salient, stuff like that. So it's like, we're going to clean this government out. We're going to clean out, the cesspool from Washington, D.C. It's like, there's Tom Cotton, when he was running in 2014, had this great line that I think could be really powerful. And it was powerful when he did it. And I think Trump should probably do the same thing. And Trump could probably sell it too. This idea that Tom would say, well, whenever I go out running in Washington, I see all these cranes because they're building all the time in Washington, D.C. There's always building. And when I go back home, they're not building. And it's like the government is getting bigger and bigger at our expense. I think that resonated.
That's a message. Yeah, that resonates. That's something that's easy for people to conceptualize, to feel it in their hearts and to understand it.
Now, I don't think Trump's going to do that. I think Trump's going to focus on trade. I think that's where he's going to try and offer people some kind of sense of direct well-being, like, oh, here, I'm fighting, the globalists, I think is the direction that he's going to want to go in. I think this sort of drain the swamp stuff was a half-hearted last-ditch effort during the campaign when they felt like they were going to lose. It was sort of like Bob Dole going to California, so I don't really think he's going to do that. So, and I actually think this is going to be a pretty bad 8 years for good, 4 to 8 years, a bad run here for people who want good, honest government. I don't think Trump's his heart isn't in that.
Well, this has been an excellent discussion of politicians, but I think maybe we should move on to a different group of rotten, decrepit cannibals. and maybe we can discuss your thoughts on The Walking Dead. And for those of our listeners who have never watched The Walking Dead, it's a show on AMC. It's about zombies. It's the apocalypse and post-apocalypse zombies. And it follows a band of survivors as they attempt to live in the world. And it has been criticized sometimes as The Talking Dead for the incessant conversations of the survivors. But Jay, why don't you go ahead and share your thoughts?
Yeah, Jay, just to kind of set it up for everybody, Jay has said that he's been watching it. He's continued to watch it, but he's almost "quote unquote," hate watching it at
hate
this
watching
point.
It.
Yes,
hate watching it.
I'm hate watching it. Yeah. Well, look, the Walking Dead is.
Should we give a spoiler alert first? I'm sorry.
No, I can keep it quiet.
Well, I guess there's certain things we might say if you haven't seen it and you're one of these ones that's like on season two, you may just want to kind of.
Well, personally, I've read the comics like way in advance of where the show is, so like I don't care.
Yeah.
But I only just got to the end of season six on Netflix, so I haven't seen the show.
Well, I will say that it is definitely the second best post-apocalyptic show on Sunday nights. It runs second, so I guess that's a nice thing to say. But because if on Sunday nights, if you want a show that resembles what the post-apocalypse would look like, you should watch The Last Man on Earth. It's a much more realistic show.
That's true.
Yeah. I watch The Walking Dead, and I'll just say this about The Walking Dead without doing any spoilers. Nobody on The Walking Dead behaves in a way that I think people would actually behave in the post-apocalypse. So, and so for people who are behind or ahead or whatever, you know, basically the story, the show is no longer really even about like the logistical problems of fighting zombies, right? Which is kind of what, like, even early on when I was watching the show, I always thought that the Grimes gang played that stupid. Like, why would they just hang out on a farm that only had fencing? Like, that didn't make any... Build a dang trench! If you're worried about getting overrun by the zombies, but the zombies can't climb, just build a trench, for goodness sake. I don't understand.
Rick is a terrible leader
He never makes
the right decision.
No, he's terrible. And you know, and the ironic thing is that you run into people who have had good ideas about how to deal with the zombies. Like for instance, Michonne, you know, like she protected herself from the zombies by knocking the jaws out of them, and then they stopped being feral, and then she used them as protection. It's like, why didn't they just do that, for goodness sake? I don't understand this.
Exactly. They never revisit these ideas.
And other things too, like if you're worried about zombies running through the countryside and leaving, you know, they're all populated in the cities and then they all sort of sweep out of the cities. Maybe, I don't know, get away from the city of Atlanta, which is like, you know, what, the fifth largest city in the country? And so they do. Okay, well, good for you. You left Atlanta. Good. Where do they go? They go to Washington, D.C., which is like the third largest city. And like, who do they follow some, you know, mealy-mouthed, mullet-headed weirdo. He's like, oh, I got a solution. And they're just like, oh, okay. The next thing you know, they're in, you know, why did you go up to the mountains, for goodness sakes? Because you know what? If they can't climb and you can climb, game, set, match. There's a whole series of like, all their logistical solutions are terrible. And then they sort of fall and ass backwards into solving these problems, like by going to Alexandria and finding a place with a wall. So good for them. And then they get themselves locked into these battles with like these warlords. But you look at these warlords and like, I keep like the newest warlord is right. Negan,
season. Right.
And I keep thinking about how every time I watch this episode, this season, I keep looking at like Negan and thinking Machiavelli would hate this guy. This guy is doing, like, if you want to be a warlord, you know, you should read Machiavelli, because that was what the whole point of The Prince was written for, was basically, you want to be a tyrant, here's the manual for being a tyrant. And like, Negan is making so many mistakes on like a Machiavellian level, and you can already see they're already telegraphing the punch that, by the way, isn't going to be delivered until April, because Negan's not going to be overthrown until the end of this season, which isn't going to be until the spring, but they've already telegraphed it because of all the excessive, ridiculous things he's done. So it's a terrible show from like a perspective of how to survive the zombie apocalypse. It's a terrible show. Like, it's kind of an interesting, like, kind of like the Road Warrior 2 kind of thing, where it's like, oh, okay, so we, you know, like the first couple seasons were like, oh, well, we have all these problems with the zombies, but the zombies are all decaying, so basically we just have Hobbes's state of nature and like these warlords. And it's like, okay, well, that's interesting, but they've screwed that up too. The whole show is just, I totally hate watching it.
Well, and you know, actually the first one they ran into, the governor, I mean, he was obviously in an extreme situation holding together society, but this is the first, like, you know, attempt to, you know, reestablish society that they've come across. And what do? They go to war with them.
They go to war with them. Exactly. I mean, it's just, I have a feeling, like, I have this thing with shows where it's like, I have one solid season where like, I watch it and I just, like, one season I like, I don't like this show anymore. And then one season where it's like, I hate this show. And then the season after that, I stop watching. So I don't know. This might be the end for me in The Walking Dead.
Well, I think a lot of people did throw up their hands and discussed the first episode of this season, which I haven't seen, but I know what happens. I think that was the breaking point for a lot of people, which actually it shouldn't have been, because to my mind, The Walking Dead has really been, playing it a little too cozy with the main characters. They hadn't killed any of the big ones that you cared about in like two or three seasons.
Yeah, that's right. And in season six, the previous season, they kept one of the main characters alive. Like, he seemed like he was going to die, but he ended up surviving, and it was the most ridiculous way that he survived. It was so stupid. And they do. They have like four or five characters who just walk around with like a little halo on their head, and you know that anybody that comes into contact with them is going to bite it. And it's just part of me, I get that, you know, because like you need a show when you have sort of audience invested in the main cast, but it really kind of makes it really very boring because you know mm-hmm. that Rick Grimes like is going to make it, you know, and they yep. do other things too. Like they pull their punches, you know, like in the comic book, you know, Rick's little daughter gets killed, but they saved her in the show, like, because they don't want it, you know, because it was too horrifying. It was horrifying. You know, her getting killed in the comic book. The comic book is horrifying, and that. But you know, they sort of have this kind of like these kind of precious halos over these cast members, and you just know that they're not going anywhere.
But yeah, and there are just some lines that they're not going to cross because you know they have to play to the television audience. They don't want those viewers to go anywhere. So it's like, you know, the whole like if Daryl dies, we riot thing.
Right, exactly.
You know, exactly. So, but
and by the way, like that whole like the fact, like you juxtapose, like you know these characters are going to make it, and that their perpetual butthurtedness, where like they are so miserable, these people, like, and it's just kind of really kind of sadistic. Like, oh yeah, Rick, we're not going to kill you. We're just going to make your life perpetually miserable, and you're never going to feel safe. It's just like. It, they're running in circles in that way because they keep doing it again and again and again. We're not going to kill Rick off, but we're going to make his life really freaking hard. It's just kind of boring.
I mean, I'm surprised they didn't cut his hand off at this point because in the comics, he's lost a hand.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Well, you never now you never know, Neil, so it could still happen.
I hope they go for it.
I guess part of what is frustrating, and everybody wanted to see what happened with the cliffhanger ending, but then ever since that point already is, I guess since they have gotten into a point where they understand how to kind of like take, you know, defend off the zombies, to keep them at bay. Now they're more like, you know, like rats rather than something that's really can harm them unless they're all being swarmed. So for the most part, they're just being kept. And so it's reverted a lot of it to kind of like a family drama, right. You know, who's falling in love with this one and this one's getting mixed up with this one. And so that's where I've kind of like lost it a little bit. But,
yeah, but they keep, you know, the occasional bout of ultra violence in there to keep you
to placate everyone. Cause it's really, cause the zombie stuff isn't just, it's like every time there's they meet up with them, it's usually over real quick. You know, there's nothing that really happens. It's done. That's it. I think the last time we actually saw where the zombies got the better of somebody was when everybody thought Glenn was killed. And it turns out that he escaped and got underneath the dumpster there and was able to make it out. So, you know, I am a little bit frustrated with this season because of the way that it's, you know, the first episode obviously was okay. Everybody, you know, saw what happened and was like, oh my God. But then since then, you know, it's just moved on. And Negan, while his act from the last episode of last season and the first episode of this season is already boring me.
Yep.
You
me
know,
too.
The swinging the thing around and smiling and kind of getting in everybody's face. And, you know, it's just, it's already, he's already a tired character. The governor, I think, was a little bit more, had a little bit more depth to him because of his background and everything. We don't even know about this guy. So. We'll see.
I have to say too that I think like this the show is mostly, in my opinion, just a ripoff of 28 Days Later. Even the origin of Rick going into a coma and think that was all on 28 Days Later. But the other thing too is like
they call it an homage, actually.
Right. Oh, okay. That's right. But it's not just that, but like the military commander was the bad guy in that movie was much more believable. But then also, you know, like the way the zombies in The Walking Dead are sort of like they're a dying force because they're all decaying and they can't sustain themselves. So, you know, in a decade, the zombies are more or less going to be gone because they're just going to be bones. I mean, they've pretty much dialed that in, that the corpses are continuing to decay and they're getting weaker and weaker. And that was part of the subtext of 28 Days Later, which gave it that they used that idea as well. But the whole thing was just executed in a much more satisfying way. That show, I think, is a much, much – that movie was superior in almost every respect to The Walking Dead.
Yeah, and it's funny. A lot of people have seen 28 Days. You know, they haven't seen 28 Weeks Later. They've seen the original, and I'm like, oh, you got it. The 28 Weeks Later was great. It was a great
really
sequel.
Really underrated.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't like the fast zombies. I thought it was too easy to become a zombie in that series. I just felt like it was fundamentally unfair. But
the rage zombies that were sprinting across the countryside.
I was just kind of like, you know, what's the point?
Right.
I'll just get blood splashed on my face so I can join the party. And I'll tell you, well, you know, The Walking Dead, I don't know if you do this, but I like to guess, you know, how long a minor character that they introduce, how many episodes they're going to last. And last season, the doctor, the girl who took over for the doctor, who started the romance with one of Rick's group, Tara. And she went out on patrol with all the guys. And I'm just going to say it, spoiler alert. She's giving this inspirational speech because she's just killed her very first zombie. She's overcome her fears, blah, blah, blah. And she's telling Daryl and Michonne how much they mean to them. And then all of a sudden, arrow through the back of the head, out her eye, just like out of nowhere, and she keeps talking, but then all of a sudden her brain starts to go and she starts bleh, 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 and then she falls over. That I thought was probably the high point of season 6.
Yeah, I agree.
I almost stood up and cheered for that one because I didn't see it coming. Like I thought, oh, she's going to be a, you know, romantic feature and blah, blah, blah. She's going to stick around. Whoa, threw me a curveball. So it could still, the show can still surprise you. I will say this. I still enjoy watching it. But it is the formula needs a little something else.
Yeah. I agree.
All right. Well, we're going to wrap it up now. Jay, we appreciate you coming on. This is great. Great discussion.
Yes. Thanks for having me, guys. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah. For the politics, the pop culture. Yeah, we do have one more order of business that we have to go through. We promise our guests that we don't hit them with any gotcha questions except for one, and this is at the end. And it's, you know, Neil and I have this kind of thing where we have this disagreement over, you know, what's better.
Many disagreements over this.
Yeah, so we for a while we were doing who was better, Frank Sinatra or Dean Martin, and then it was Die Hard a Christmas movie. So we have since moved on. And when we asked this question, we were talking about the franchises, not one particular show, one particular movie. We were talking about the entire franchise.
Don't contextualize it too much. Let's just ask the question.
Well, because every time we ask the question, people are like, well, what about this?
Or you sit here and you're leading the witness, sir. So, Jay, I'm going to ask the question. I'm just going to cut to the chase.
Okay.
Which is better, Star Trek or Star Wars?
Okay, let me think about this. Star Trek.
Yes, finally. Finally. You didn't even have the music queued up.
I had the Star Wars. The Star Wars.
Of course
music.
You had the Star Wars music queued up. Well, thank you, Mr. Cost, because that was the correct answer.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
Actually, you're the first one. You're the first one to come down on the side of the Federation.
Is that right? Well, yeah. I have to say that I hated The Force Awakens with the burning passion of a thousand suns. And if you had asked me that question a year ago, I probably would have said Star Wars, because I can kind of forgive the prequels. I think they're badly executed, but they have an interesting story. But I hated The Force Awakens. And I thought in my head when you asked that question, I thought of Star Trek II versus, you know, The Wrath of Khan versus The Force Awakens.
No contest. Although, to be fair, that is the best Star Trek movie and all the rest of them fail to live up to it.
Oh, yes. And I'm not even sure. I don't think a Star Wars movie. I mean, and I love the original trilogy, but I'm really hard pressed to think of a better I don't think it gets any better than that. I love that movie. It's
Yeah.
perfect. It's a perfect
I mean,
movie.
let's be honest, Star Wars is a fable for children, and Star Trek is an adult drama. It's about relationships between grown-ups.
It's true. I just, you know what? I just love that movie, though. I have to say, just Kirk, you know, Shatner and Ricardo Montalban just chewing up scenery. I could mm-hmm. watch. They should have done 5 movies. They should have killed Khan off. They could have just kept the two of them just chasing each other around. I could have watched that for like 5 more hours.
Oh, honestly. if it had come out for the first time now, it would have been split up into 2 movies.
Oh, absolutely, because it's just so brilliant. Brilliant movie. It's amazing. It's amazingly good. Oh, yeah. Oh, so good. That so original good. Cast. I love that original cast.
Man, this is the best episode I've had in a while.
Oh, there you go.
But anyway, but yes, thank you again for making the time to come on with us, especially, you know, the holiday season approaching. We certainly do appreciate it. And
yeah, we do.
And we hope to have you on again sometime.
Yeah, that'd be great. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and definitely if you know at some point when you know your dissertation is done, it becomes a book, and you know then we'd love to have you on and kind of talk
great.
About that, because that'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah, cool.
All right, well, thank you, and you have a great Thanksgiving, Neil. Safe flight, and
yes, safe travels, Neil.
Yeah, enjoy your Thanksgiving
you,
as well. And we wish everybody else out there a happy Thanksgiving. Don't forget, if you like this podcast, if you like what you hear, go out there, subscribe, leave us a rating. We love it when you do that. And we'll see you next time here on The Fifth Estate.